the Tehran startup scene today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A group of young Iranians returned home from abroad. Their goal? To become a part of Tehran's tech startup scene, and they say the government's behind them.
The government here funds startup events. It helps accelerators getting venues and especially universities. So all these have been done by the government.
Another Tehran story coming up. Also, not sure what Russia's up to in Syria? Well, neither are the experts.
Nobody knows what Russia's end game is.
And the skater girls in Havana who are turning heads.
It's actually something that's seen as kind of bizarre. It's not a normal, quote-unquote, activity for a woman.
Those stories plus the dead zoo gang today on The World. Thanks for being with us this Tuesday. I hope it is a super Tuesday for you. Voting does matter, and all you have to do is look at Iran, which is where we'll spend the first part of the show today. Last weekend, Iranians went to the polls to elect members of two political bodies. One is parliament. The other is a circle of clergy known as the Assembly of Experts, who appoint the next supreme leader there. Thomas Erdbrink is keeping an eye on what we know so far about results. He's in Tehran for the New York Times.
Basically, only the results for the capital, Tehran, and some other big cities are known, and the Ministry of Interior has also said that a large portion of all the 290 seats in the parliament has been allocated. But only for Tehran, we know actually which faction has won. And Tehran, this was a sounding victory for Iran's moderate reformist coalition, supporters of the government, if you will. But for the rest of the country, the picture is much more unclear. The Ministry of Interior is not declaring what affiliation the individual candidates have. And therefore, it's very hard to decipher which faction, hardliners, reformists, moderates, actually has won this election.
Yeah, how much do results in Tehran reflect the rest of the country? Is it really two completely different things?
Well, the city of Tehran is, of course, the capital, and a lot of people would think that Tehran, being a metropolis with over 12 million inhabitants, is very different from the rest of the country. But Iran as a country is actually a very urbanized nation, and there are several huge cities where people have the same hopes and dreams as, roughly as the middle class in Tehran, who voted massively for that reformist moderate coalition. The fact that we are not seeing a sounding reformist moderate victory across the country probably has to do with the fact that thousands of reformist candidates, well-known politicians, were disqualified beforehand from participating in these elections. So that makes it also harder to, again, decipher who has won and which faction has got how many seats.
So let's just take the Tehran results then. How significant is it that there was this kind of big turnout, this heavy turnout for the moderates and reformists?
Basically, what happened is that Iran's middle class, symbolized by the people who live in Tehran, have long longed for change in this country. And in elections, they always tend to vote for the faction or group that promises more personal freedoms, better relations with other countries, a better economy. And during these elections, the middle class of Tehran came out in full force, almost exclusively supporting the reformist moderate coalition. So therefore, you could see these long lines in polling stations in the middle class and more wealthier neighborhoods. But when you would go down to the southern part of the city, where more poorer people live, you would see much less enthusiasm for the voting. So this huge turnout of one group of supporters has led to this overwhelming victory in which the reformist moderate coalition, the supporters of the government, if you will, took all of the 30 seats allocated for the capital for Tehran.
What are you hearing from the Iranians in Tehran? Are they excited by what they're seeing so far with these results?
I think people are very excited because a lot of them just came out to take their revenge on the hardliners. I would stand in line at the voting booths with people, and they would tell me, I don't know any of these people that I'm voting for other than the fact that they are supporting Rouhani. What I want, they would say, is an end to hardliner domination of the parliament. Now that we're a couple of days onwards and that the results have not been fully announced yet, a lot of people are saying, well, at least we did what we could, and now it's up to the politicians.
Thomas Erdbrink of the New York Times in Tehran. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Regardless of the outcome of Iran's election, there's a group of people that are not waiting to see what changes. The young entrepreneurs behind the lively tech startup scene. Producer and reporter Matthew Bell and I went to meet three of them, the guys behind Tech Rasa. It's a startup consultancy that tracks the progress of other startups in Iran. Matthew's with me here in the studio. And Matthew, you'll recall that I was kind of obsessed by the little details of life in Tehran. Like, how do young Iranian entrepreneurs commute to work?
So we started by meeting Tech Rasa's Hamid Jafari at his grandmother's house in North Tehran. Hamid is 25. He's tall, lanky, and very chill. He was wearing the universal outfit of startup entrepreneurs worldwide, a zip-up hoodie, tight pants, and sneakers. His commute, as we found out, involves two taxis and a bus ride and takes about an hour. Hamid gave us a preview of what we'd be hearing and seeing from his colleagues at Tech Rasa headquarters.
Basically, we're writers, we're community builders, startup community builders. We're writing about the startup ecosystem in Iran, what is going on here. We're writing about the local entrepreneurs in Iran. And we're also interviewing Iranian entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley. We want to be a bridge between them.
And, Marco, you remember Hamid saying that Iranians from abroad have been sending him emails, especially after the sanctions started to be lifted. He told us that people ask about work opportunities in Tehran, and he tells them, come see for yourselves and prepare to be surprised.
Yeah, he's kind of a bridge himself, speaking of bridges. Hamid lived in Ottawa for 3 years before coming back to Tehran, where he was born and where his family lives.
You know, I'm a religious guy. I consider myself a religious person. I pray five times a day. That's surprising for even some Iranian people when I tell them, because I speak English, I'm working, you know, with foreigners. But, you know, it's normal for me, living here at the same time. In my free time, I'm watching, like, American TV shows. I'm watching Saturday Night Live. I'm listening to, like, American hip-hop. But that's me. That's the real me, you know?
Hey, guys.
Good morning. How are you?
Matthew.
Hi, I'm Marco.
That's one of Hamid's partners, Tech Rasa co-founder Mohammad Reza Azali. He's greeting Matthew and me outside their new office in Tehran's hottest business district.
They started the venture at a university incubator in Tehran, but now they've got their own space, which smelled like fresh paint and plaster. Mohammad is 28 years old. That makes him the old man of the team.
8 months ago, we quit our jobs to start this thing. We had so much trouble. Because in normal way, you can make that kind of money. Because we have many websites that have tons of millions of visitors per day, and we can make that kind of money from online advertisement. So it was, I think that it was only love, because we loved what we were doing.
And Matthew, we both got the sense that that love is starting to pay off for these guys.
For sure. And this is a good moment for me to introduce Ali Reza Josi. He's the third co-founder of Tech Rasa. He's 23. And he says they do write reports about the startup scene in Iran, but what brings in the money are the services they offer, like marketing and public relations.
We also provide consultancy to companies, startup companies that want to enter Iran. So that was our major revenue source till now, and we never raised funds, so we never invested, we never got investment or anything. So just to have our independency, so these bootstrapping methods actually really came in handy to maintain ourselves.
Like many companies came to us and asked us, "Hey guys, you know your stuff. Can you do the media communication for us? Can you do the like social media strategy for us?" And we were, hey guys, we can do it. And they want to pay. So why not?
We had to make money somehow, right?
Yeah.
Matthew, remember what Ali Reza said about most startups in Iran? They face the same challenges they do anywhere in the world, finding talent, attracting smart funding.
But he also said that in Iran, there are some unique challenges as well.
Hamid, I read an interview where you said that borders don't mean anything to us. You see the world as kind of your oyster. But for politicians here in Iran, they see a lot of borders. How do you work with that?
It's not only Iranian politicians. Every politician says that. But we can build something great from Iran. We have startups here that are targeting the customers in the United States. and they're making money right now.
These guys were so up and so optimistic, but the thing that seems to really irk them is their inability to travel. If you have only an Iranian passport, that means you cannot just jump on a plane without a visa and fly to pretty much most countries in the world. Right. That makes it very difficult to attend conferences or meet with potential business partners.
And we also asked them about the fact that if they were dual nationals, they might be targeted by the Iranian regime, like the case of an Iranian-American businessman who was detained back in October.
What about the case of Siamak Namazi, who was a businessman, a dual national, and is in jail? I mean, does that inhibit you, or does that give you any reason for concern?
I don't know what he did. We're not political people, but we're not doing anything illegal here. We're trying to promote Iran's startup ecosystem to the world. So that's what, I don't think that would be a problem for us. And they're actually supporting us. Actually, the new government is helping the startup movement that is happening in Iran.
You know, Matthew, I got the sense that the Tech Rasa guys did not want to wade into the Siamak Namazi story, either because they're totally focused startup guys or because they don't want to annoy the government.
Ahmed did tell us, though, that he's read stuff in hardline Iranian newspapers about the startup scene there being a security threat because it's allegedly a way for Western countries to come in and steal from Iran. But he said, look, the truth is the folks in Iran's startup scene are the ones borrowing from the West.
The World's Matthew Bell, thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
We have a couple of minutes now before the next break, just enough time to note the news that Starbucks is boldly going where no venti latte has ever gone before, Italy. A country with, let's say, some of the pickiest coffee drinkers in the world because Italian baristas make some of the most awesome cups of coffee in the world. The Seattle-based coffee giant announced yesterday that it's planning to open its first store in Italy early next year. It'll be in Milan. And that's kind of completing the circle for Starbucks founder Howard Schultz. He says he got the idea of bringing espresso culture to the U.S. while visiting Milan back in the 1980s. So what took so long? Chiara Albanese is a reporter for Bloomberg in Rome. She thinks Starbucks faces a real challenge breaking into Italy's coffee culture.
Italians are really loyal and traditional when it comes to coffee. They do like their espresso in the morning. They like it very dark, very short. According to the Italian Federation of Coffee, Italians drink 6 billion of espresso in a year. And they are quite skeptical when it comes to American coffee, so probably Starbucks was scared of just not being able to break into that tradition.
Albanese says Starbucks will have to convince Italians that American coffee is not synonymous with bad quality or a watered-down version of the real thing, not to mention that most Italians would never dream of having their coffee in a cardboard cup.
I was in a recent meeting, and I moved back to Italy from London recently, and I still tend to drink Americano, and they were looking at me in a really bad way just because I was not drinking an espresso. So there is a bit of a stigma associated to drinking long coffee in a paper cup in Italy.
And here's another challenge for Starbucks. Italians don't really hang out over coffee, comfy couch or not. They're more used to walking up to their neighborhood coffee bar and chugging their espresso on the spot, and then they're off. But Bloomberg reporter Chiara Albanese thinks some Italians could be open to rethinking that routine.
And those who might be is the younger generation, the ones that drink coffee while working, so they could make use of Starbucks space, the idea of like bringing your laptop to a coffee shop, routing to the Wi-Fi, and spending a couple of hours working, which is not something you can do in a typical coffee shop here, where you sip your cappuccino standing or just on the go.
Starbucks is moving cautiously into Italy. The chain is planning to open just one new franchise in Milan at first. Others could follow if enough Italians change their coffee habits. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. If there's one country on the planet that's anxious about protecting democracy and justice for its minorities, it's Germany. Germany's history with the Nazis and then the communists in the east of the country has produced a legacy of incredibly strong protections for liberty. So it's hard for them to ban a political party, even a far-right party that's been accused of stoking hostility to immigrants and Jews. But that attempt is currently being made and has now reached the equivalent of Germany's Supreme Court. Freelance journalist Felix Husmann writes extensively about the far right in Germany from his base in Dortmund. So what is this party we're talking about, Felix, and what is wrong with them?
Well, the NPD is a neo-Nazi party, so they're not just right-wing, they're neo-Nazis. They're hardcore anti-Semites, they're racists. Their ideology has more in common with the historical ideology of the Nazis back in the old days in Germany than with free and open democracy. That's the party we're talking about, basically.
And NPD stands for what?
That stands for National Democratic Party of Germany, but the democratic in this name is merely a name. They don't really care about democracy. Democracy and the parliamentary elections and the whole democratic process, for them, this is just one set in a toolkit to basically abolish democracy and to abolish a free and open society.
Is there any evidence that the NPD is involved in stoking violence in Germany?
Well, just today when I was on a train, I read a headline about an NPD member getting arrested for the suspicion of arsony at the refugee center. There's stuff like this. There's NPD members who have been sentenced for violent crimes and for hate speech over and over again over the years. So yes, the NPD is heavily linked to racist violence, to racist hate speech, and to open anti-Semitism.
I understand that it's a tiny group, the NPD. It's got like 5,000 members nationwide in Germany. They've got no members in parliament. So why is everyone so worried about them? Why even try to ban them?
Well, they have members in German state assemblies. They never made it into the Bundestag, the national parliament. But in some regions in Germany, for example, if you take Mecklenburg-Vorpommern and Brandenburg, for example, they are getting funded by taxpayers' money there because they are in local parliaments or in state parliaments in some cases. And with this money they get from the taxpayer, they fund neo-Nazi activity. They fund other neo-Nazi groups that are even far more radical and openly violent than the NPD. And this is why so many people here in Germany think this has to stop. We don't want to fund Nazi propaganda and right-wing violence.
How is that even possible that taxpayer dollars in Germany are funding neo-Nazi groups?
Well, they run for elections, and if they reach a certain threshold, a certain percentage, they get some of the costs they spend for their propaganda back. They receive money, of course, by they're publicly funded once they make it into state assemblies. So they are funded like all other democratic parties by the state, and they share the same rights and the same benefits as other democratic parties, with the big difference that they don't give anything about democracy.
Is anyone in Germany concerned that despite the racist views of the NPD, this is, at the end of the day, kind of a freedom of speech and assembly issue, and banning the NPD would be prohibiting a group from existing?
Of course, those sentiments exist, but within a democratic discourse, I think most people who are critical about the ban, a possible ban of the NPD, rather argue from the point that if we ban them, they might radicalize themselves, they might go underground. I think this is a more commonplace argument against the ban of the NPD here in Germany.
Journalist Felix Husmann speaking with me from Dortmund, Germany. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Across the Persian Gulf from Iran, there's a tiny island nation that's linked to Saudi Arabia by a narrow causeway. That's Bahrain. Back in 2011, there were protests there inspired by the Arab Spring. Bahrain's uprising got a lot of media attention briefly. The uprising was quickly quashed and the media moved on. But the protests have continued. Last month, journalist Anna Therese Day traveled to Bahrain to report on that. It did not go well. Day and three of her colleagues were arrested and held for 48 hours.
My camera crew and I were reporting in a neighborhood called Sitra. It's a majority Shia neighborhood, and it's one of the flashpoints of the ongoing clashes between police and the people. We went to Sitra because most of the popular demonstrations have been pushed off the main thoroughfares of the island. So you can drive down the main highways and it looks like this glistening Gulf Kingdom. But if you look off the highways into the neighborhoods, you can see clouds of smoke. And these clashes have been happening with the police every single day since February 14th, 2011.
So, Anna, when you were arrested, were you mistreated?
Yes, we were mistreated in two specific scenarios that we have filed complaints about and will pursue charges against the police. In general, we were deprived of food, water, medicine, and prevented from calling attorneys, our embassy, and our family.
You were working as a journalist, but you went into Bahrain without a journalist visa, right?
Yes.
Why do that?
We wish we lived in a world where freedom of the press was respected in all the countries in which we report. However, not just in Bahrain, but in many of the countries that I will continue to report in, a media visa essentially gives you a government minder. Oftentimes, it could endanger your sources if you're meeting with them undercover. And that's precisely what we were doing in Bahrain.
How did you finally get released, you and your crew?
You know, it's a little bit unclear, but of course we know that the embassy did mobilize all of its resources and levers and influence to get us released. We are still being charged and under investigation in Bahrain. And in fact, when we were released, we were taken to our apartment to grab our things before going to the airport. When we entered the apartment, the entire place had been ransacked, all of our electronics confiscated. So right now they have over $20,000 worth of our gear. Of course, we're grateful to be out safely, but we are hoping for, you know, professional and swift closure to this case.
I gather at one point there was great concern about the footage that you had already shot on video. Do you still have that?
Yes, we were able to smuggle it out.
You were very careful not to tell any of your crew where it was. Are you able to tell us how you smuggled it out?
We knew that we would be searched. And we also knew that not only did we want to get the material out to tell the story, but we also would have risked the arrest and possible lives of some of our sources had they been able to access these memory cards. So I did carry them within my body cavity.
Why take these risks?
I think we feel very strongly about reporting this story, not only to, you know, honor the experiences of those victims of these crackdowns, but also to inform the American audience. America's Fifth Fleet, one of our largest and most significant military installations in the entire world, is based just off of Bahrain's coast. We have anywhere between 5 to 15,000 American servicemen and women working there and calling Bahrain their home. When we were in police detention, we could actually see American servicemen from the window of a police station that has been used to torture and round up political protesters. So that proximity and that very visible, you know, and stark juxtaposition between democratic values, which we claim to espouse, and the compromises we've made in terms of defense became even clearer while I was there in detention. But it's why we set out to do the story in the first place.
Anna Therese Day is an independent journalist who writes about the Middle East. She and three of her colleagues were arrested in Bahrain earlier this month and held for 48 hours. Anna, thanks very much for telling us your story. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Later on the show, an Oscar for production design has its origins in the desert, on the world. I'm Marco Werman. A gang of thieves in Britain went after some big game.
So if you're thinking in old castles and museums, these big taxidermized rhinoceros heads that maybe were killed 100, 200 years ago, they were going in and ripping the horns off.
And folks in Asia were willing to pay a lot for that. The tale of the Dead Zoo Gang, ahead on the world.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It's not a full-on ceasefire in Syria. Call it a partial truce, or as the diplomats who worked it out call it, a cessation of hostilities. Whatever it is, few thought it would be this effective at putting the fighting on the ground in Syria almost on pause.
It has astounded people. Bombing runs, for example, the average is 6 a day rather than 100 a day.
That's Joshua Landis. He specializes in the Middle East at the University of Oklahoma.
I think it shows how dependent all the actors are on the ground in Syria on their sponsors, the big nations that are feeding them with arms, money, and diplomatic protection. So this is essentially a deal that was made between America and Russia and is being pushed on the Syrians. And so far, it's working.
Other deals between the parties have not worked out. I think the ramp up to this one was also pessimism. So the deal between Moscow and Washington, was there more to that deal than we might know?
You know, that's an excellent question. And I think that's what everybody is debating today. Tons of Arab press speculating that America and Russia have made some deal to divide up Syria. That's the scuttlebutt in the Arabic press. But it's unclear. Nobody knows what Russia's end game is. Advisors to Assad are being very close-mouthed. Nobody can get information out of Damascus. What are their next moves? What does this mean? Is Russia pushing you to continue the truce even beyond the two-week temporary official limit of this truce? So is Russia preparing to pull back from Assad? Is this a real deal between America and Russia, or is it a temporary truce? And will Russia continue to bomb and push for more territory? And will the Assad army continue to go in advance?
I mean, those are great questions. So let me ask you, what do you think Russia's game plan is at this point?
A week ago, I believed that Russia and Assad were on the march, that they were taking back territory at a fairly quick clip, that the Syrian opposition rebel forces were in chaos and falling backwards, and that Assad would want to press his advantage. And I think he did want to press his advantage. But the Russians have signed on to this deal with America. I thought it was just Russia giving a little sugar to America so that the medicine would go down, the medicine of Russia taking this back and basically asserting Assad as the ruler of Syria again. But I'm not sure right now. I can't quite figure it out. And that has us all on tenterhooks, and it has everybody in Syria on tenterhooks.
When UN officials go into this next round of peace talks on March 9th in Geneva, what sort of leverage is U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry going to bring to the table?
Not very much. President Obama, on September 30th, when Russia entered into the war with its Air Force in a big way, President Obama said, the United States is not going to fight a proxy war with Russia for Syria. That means that America is standing aside. Now, Saudi Arabia and Turkey and other Gulf countries still want to send in more arms, are insisting that Assad cannot remain. But America's not going to get involved in this war. And possibly the next president might. But none of them have articulated a policy towards the Syrian civil war that looks very energetic. So America doesn't have a lot of leverage. It's counting on Russia wanting to get out of this and not get stuck in a quagmire and looking for a way to consolidate Assad's gains but not have to commit to helping him conquer a lot more territory that may be very difficult to do. So that's basically America's hope is that Russia's had enough of this.
So how far is Vladimir Putin willing to go for Bashar al-Assad?
There's the million-dollar question. I mean, so far he looks like a tough guy who's willing to go a long way, and he wants to destroy al-Qaeda in Syria and ISIS. Putin said, we're going to destroy terrorism because there are 3,000 Russians fighting as jihadists in Syria. We don't want them coming home. And America has done a terrible job. America's democracy promotion regime change policy in the Middle East has only expanded the amount of failed regimes and extremists running around the Middle East, many of whom are going to come back to motherland Russia and try to blow us up. So we're going to take charge of this. We're going to assert a strongman Assad over his state, and we're going to kill these jihadists. That was Putin's promise. Now, how much of that is he going to insist on carrying out? We'll have to wait and see.
Joshua Landis heads the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. His blog is Syria Comment. Joshua, thanks very much, as always.
It's always a pleasure to be asked on. Thank you.
The American war against extremism relies heavily on drones. Just think of the airstrikes against ISIS militants in Syria and Iraq. But not all U.S. drones around the globe are raining missiles on fighters on the ground. Take the battle against Boko Haram in Central Africa. American help there is all about surveillance and intelligence gathering, and that's being done from a remote U.S. drone base in northern Cameroon. The Intercept's Joshua Hammer traveled there to see what's going on at Air Base 301.
Well, they've been in place since October. They're slowly ramping up operations. They're flying drones over the Cameroon-Nigeria border, which in the last couple of years has become a major confrontation point, major conflict point between the militaries there and the Boko Haram Islamic extremist terrorist group. The Islamic group, which is based in Nigeria, has been moving across the border in waves, sometimes large groups of fighters, sometimes suicide bombers. The Cameroon government wanted help. The Nigerians wanted help. And the U.S. stepped in to create a base that would allow for surveillance and intelligence to get a better idea of how they're moving and how they can be stopped.
So if the stated mission of the drone base is surveillance, is that what you observed when you were on the ground there?
Well, that's what I observed was very little. You can't get on the base. You know, I prowled around the edges of the base, talked to as many people as I could to get a sense of what was happening. And there are drones flying around the clock. I did hang out at the local observation post, which is a ramshackle bar across the road from the base, and encountered a fellow who had been there the day before and showed me photos that he'd taken, sure enough, of one of these drones that had just finished a mission and was coming in for a landing.
So the Nigerian government had been complaining that it didn't have accurate intelligence to pursue Boko Haram. Is the drone operation helping, and who else is getting the intelligence?
Both militaries were complaining. As one diplomat told me, the Cameroonians were being hit with these. They have a bunch of soldiers along the border. They have 2,500 soldiers or so, but these guys until recently have been equipped with basically with binoculars. As one diplomat told me, it's World War I technology. So they were essentially functioning blind. These waves of Boko Haram fighters were coming across in these suicidal attacks and just creating a tremendous amount of damage. Now the drones are up and running. They're offering, you know, real-time observation of the movements of these fighters, of where their suicide bomb factories are. So the first operation took place about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and they conducted a very successful operation, the Nigerians and the Cameroonians together. Using surveillance technology provided by the drones, they were able to mount a very successful operation against a Boko Haram held town. They got very clear pictures of where these guys were, where the bomb factories were, even where hostages were being held, and went through two defensive lines of Boko Haram fighters, entered the town, retook the town, freed the hostages, and seized bomb-making equipment. If this continues, it could be a serious accomplishment and a serious step towards eradicating this group, which is so far in the 6 years of horrendous violence has been pretty much impossible to stop.
Is anyone suggesting using these drones to launch missile attacks on Boko Haram, as is done in other parts of the world?
Yeah, the Obama administration has been pretty clear that they don't want to do that. They say this is an African fight. We're willing to help. We're willing to provide surveillance. But they really say this is the job of the Nigerians and the Cameroonians and the Chadians and the Nigerians. It's their job, at least for the near future. They are ruling out any sort of direct arming of these drones. They can be armed very easily, but they're being very clear at the moment, very adamant. No, this is not going to happen.
Joshua, finally, this drone base in northern Cameroon you went to, it's in a place called Garoua, and you write that until recently about the only Westerners to visit Garoua were big game hunters and safari goers. Who did you see coming and going now as you arrived at the local airport?
Well, I saw both soldiers and big game hunters. The big game hunters are still coming to shoot elephants, believe it or not,
wow,
and water buffalo. I think Cameroon is one of the only countries left in the world that you can shoot elephants. But the safari goers and hunters are now coming simultaneously on the same flights with American soldiers, coming in small numbers. They're up to about 120, 140 now. But yeah, they're coming in. There's no question that there's activity going on up there.
Joshua Hammer with The Intercept, thanks very much for your reporting and your time.
You're welcome.
So it's still legal to shoot elephants in Cameroon. In most of Africa, though, elephants are protected from being hunted to extinction, which brings me to our next story about a group of very specialized thieves called the Dead Zoo Gang, a tantalizing name if ever there was one. Several members of this Dead Zoo Gang have been found guilty of stealing artifacts from museums around Britain. Donna Yates studies the trafficking of antiquities at the University of Glasgow.
This gang, for quite some time, focused very specifically on rhinoceros horns. So if you're thinking in old castles and museums, these big taxidermized rhinoceros heads that maybe were killed 100, 200 years ago, they were going in and ripping the horns off.
So the Dead Zoo Gang would go into museums or old castles and just cleverly take them. I suppose they would be caught if they were doing it in broad daylight. What else were they taking?
In two cases, quite later in their criminal activity, they robbed major museums and were focusing on small but very valuable Chinese antiquities.
And why antiquities? Was it ivory they were after?
No, these were actually jade items. It seems like they were focusing more on the market rather than the material. So the primary market for any rhinoceros horn, including stolen rhinoceros horn, is Asia and specifically China. It's an elite item that's ground up and used as kind of a phony type of medicine. But the same people buying this rhinoceros horn are the people who are buying high-end Asian art, so extremely expensive, valuable things.
So the market is the same for rhino horn and some of these like Chinese vases?
It's the same people. It's the same people who have that kind of money, who want these elite status items.
Wow. Did that surprise you?
It did, actually. In most museum thefts, they seem to be almost random crimes of convenience, and they don't seem really well thought out. And we tend to find that thieves can't fence the items, they can't sell the painting on. If you steal the Mona Lisa, who can buy the Mona Lisa? But these were very targeted thefts, and we can absolutely see that the thieves were targeting these marketable Chinese things for a Chinese market. And we do know that the market was China for this, as they had businesses in Hong Kong passing it into the Chinese market.
Have you ever come across a group of thieves like the Dead Zoo Gang?
Not like this. This is quite astounding. The level of organization is really quite high. And the people who were convicted just recently are kind of the higher echelon of this organization. So they were actually hiring groups of low-level petty thieves to hit these various auction houses and museums for rhino horn and antiquities, which, again, it's usually not that organized when we're talking about museum theft.
So with this conviction of the group's senior leadership, do you think it's likely that the heists are going to stop? I mean, how much of a dent will these convictions actually make in the whole business?
I think there's two sides of it. I think absolutely the highest level of this particular gang has been taken out. But the other side of it, when it comes to the rhinoceros horns, they pretty much stole what was available. So there aren't many rhinoceros horns around in publicly displayed collections for
like
anybody
in the whole
to
world?
Steal. Yeah, the convictions yesterday dealt with only UK cases, but these exact same people committed these crimes in Ireland, in the United States, in Australia. They were a far-reaching gang.
Let me ask you one more thing about cultural treasures, Dr. Yates. Today, in what seems to be an unprecedented move, the International Criminal Court in The Hague is holding a hearing on whether the destruction of cultural treasures in Timbuktu and Mali by militants, including a mosque, shrines of ancient Sufi saints, whether that constitutes a war crime. I'd like to know what your thoughts are on this, and will it help to actually stop such destruction?
Well, I think this is actually like a really exciting case to watch because it is the first time that an individual is being brought to the International Criminal Court for an antiquities crime. And the idea is that culture and heritage are almost human rights, or are human rights, and the destruction of such things are a deliberate attack on specific people and groups, or just all of humanity in general. And it's really quite exciting that this is happening. I can't say if this kind of prosecution will cut down on such things, but the possibilities of actually getting some closure for people who've experienced these kinds of crimes is really quite exciting.
So before I let you go, Dr. Yates, make the case why culture is a human right.
Oh, that's a very difficult question. Well, it's an inherent part of our identity. History, the past, is part of our present and how we see ourselves. And direct attacks on it are attacks on certain identities and certain beliefs. And as such, to take that away from us is taking our identity away from us. It's taking away who we are.
Dr. Donna Yates at the University of Glasgow, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Anytime.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. This weekend, I think I'm going to have to see Mad Max Fury Road just to see what all the fuss is about. It did pull down 6 Oscars, after all. Sound, production design, hairstyling, makeup, much more. You may already know all of that. Unfortunately, there is no category for very tough location. Otherwise, it might have gotten 7 Oscars. Mad Max Fury Road is set in a futuristic desert, a wasteland where there's little gasoline and water is a precious commodity. Reporter Aaron Conway-Smith with our Global Post team joins me now from Johannesburg. So where were the desert scenes in Mad Max shot, Aaron?
Well, they were actually shot in Namibia. They were meant to be shot in Australia, but at the last minute, very unexpected rainfall caused flowers to start growing all over the place and the sand to look a little bit too green. And so they had to move it.
Yeah. Doesn't read desert. So let's go to a real desert. Is this the Namib Desert?
That's right, the Namib Desert. I've actually been there a few times, and it's in Namibia, which is in the southern part of Africa along the Atlantic Ocean coast. Pretty remote spot with very few people, just the sort of landscape you'd want when you're trying to portray the sort of post-apocalyptic feel to a film.
Now, what did shooting Mad Max Fury Road in the Namib Desert do? Did it cause any harm?
Well, that's the concern, because it is a very fragile landscape. I mean, having been there, I can tell you that it feels like you're on the moon or something like that, like maybe on another planet. I mean, on first glance, it doesn't look like anything can live at all in that environment. It rains, you know, barely half an inch a year. But when you look closer, you'll find that there's all kinds of little creatures living in the sand, snakes and chameleons and geckos, as well as really rare plant life, lichens and other sorts of things. And so there was a great concern that the filming would damage some of these areas.
Yeah, so a lot of fragile little plants and critters in that desert. Let's hear what the Namibia Film Commissioner Vixen Hangula had to say about Mad Max Fury Road. He was speaking on a windy day to a journalist in Cannes in France.
There were some environmentalists from Namibia who were asking whether shooting in that pristine landscape, the desert, which is for centuries has been protected, whether it will not damage the environment and so on. However, the positive thing that the producers of Mad Max did is to take a botanist, and they actually did the tests, and they cleaned up afterwards. And it is fine, like it wasn't touched.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there was one tour guide who's based in the area who said that he saw the film crew in sort of sensitive parts of the Dorob National Park, which is where some of it was filmed, where the film crew wasn't supposed to go. The thing about that park is that they've carved out areas for recreation, but then there's parts that you're not supposed to touch, just because even just driving over the landscape can cause huge damage. So apparently the filmmakers had dragged some of the areas to get rid of the tire tracks and the marks, but that was just sort of making things a little bit worse by kind of dragging the landscape after.
Okay, what I really want to know now, Aaron, is how long have there been pirated DVDs of Mad Max Fury Road on the streets of Johannesburg?
Yeah, probably faster than it came into the theaters here, that's for sure.
Okay, reporter Aaron Conway-Smith with our team at Global Post. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
You can't skateboard in sand in the desert, but when I heard about a reporter going down to Cuba to check out the skateboarding scene there, I had one image in my head, a long, steep avenue called La Rampa. Take a skateboard down that, and you are zooming right into downtown Havana traffic. Technically, it's not legal to skateboard in Cuba, but that's not stopping a group of determined young women there. Miami New Times writer Jessica Weiss met some of them when she traveled to Cuba.
They skate to get around, to get to school, to get to work, for fun, to meet up with friends. So it's definitely a part of everybody's day-to-day life. It's a passion. Among girls, it's a tricky because there are so few that are skating that it was really just very notable that they didn't really hold a big place in the scene that itself is quite large.
So you were saying people are skateboarding to work. You see a lot of people out on skateboards. All this is happening even though skateboarding is technically illegal?
So skateboarding falls into that legal gray area. And so in skateboarding, you know, it is this sort of act of rebellion because you're not doing something that's technically considered legal. It's not a sport. And so I think that there is a little bit of a sense of a collective sort of eye roll at the skaters. But yes, that does not stop them in the least.
So officials turn a blind eye to the borders. What about women skateboarders? When they ride down the street, how do people react?
It's actually something that's seen as kind of bizarre. It's not a normal, quote-unquote, activity for a woman. The girl skater from Come Away that I met, Ariadna, she had told me that when she was on the bus ride from Come Away to Havana, which, by the way, is a 12-hour ride, a woman had noticed her skateboard and said, you know, my daughter wants to try that, but I can't let her because she's a dancer and it's going to scrape up her legs. And so there's a certain sense of it being not a girl's activity. And so among the few, you know, girls and young women that I spoke to that are skaters, there was this definite sense of receiving quite a few stares and unapproving glances from onlookers. For sure.
So not a girl's activity. Is there also like Cuban machista, the whole macho attitude of men on the island? Does that also kind of play into all of this?
Not only is there a sense that the man needs to protect the women, but also that the woman as the wife or the daughter or, you know, the sister is sort of there to be protected. So that has definitely filtered into, I think, the way that Cuban society still works. Skating is an activity that is pretty treacherous. You do sometimes fall, and there's not always gear to protect yourself when that happens. So I think if you're going to talk about, you know, the sort of this predominant sense of the fragility of the woman or, you know, needing to be protected, that would definitely play into an extreme sport.
So, Jessica, you're down there in Havana. You see all these things that the girls are up against. What was it like just watching them say essentially whatever and then bomb down a hill on their skateboard?
It was quite an amazing feeling to just sense the freedom and the liberation that they experience being on that skateboard. You know, I talked about this girl, Belgi, she's 16, you know, and she just loves the speed. She loves hills. She loves to just get speed on her longboard and just cruise down. And for her, that's a thrill. That's something that she says makes her feel alive. It makes her feel her. So just to know that there's this sort of vehicle that allows for that sense of adventure and exploration and speed and to do something different, it was an incredible thing to watch. And I felt so happy that they, you know, could access those feelings.
Jessica Weiss reports from Miami New Times. Since she got back from Cuba, she's acquired a longboard. Happy carving. That'll do it for us from the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.